Kick-Ass Vets, sharing tips to help empower you to take control of your career. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Today, we are super, super excited to have Dr. Brooke with us. Dr. Brooke, I was incredibly lucky to very, very briefly interact with Brooke when she was going through her final year rotation at an emergency center. And as a student, she was just like, blew us out of the water. Phenomenal, phenomenal student. And I remember you being like, oh, I hope I get the internship job and I hope I'm good enough. And I was like, Brooke, you're good enough. I promise you, you're good enough. And then you've gone on to work in emergency and then do a lot of other really cool things. So if you want to introduce yourself and kind of tell us a bit about your background, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, certainly. And thank you so much for having me on here. I really, really appreciate it. And I think I was so lucky to cross paths with you. You know, doing placement with you guys down in Melbourne was definitely one of the highlights of my year. And I still remember we were managing, we had a metaldehyde smell day.
Yeah, a bad one.
Yeah. And then at the same time we were managing that case, a dog attack came in and its jugular vein was obliterated and it was bleeding everywhere. And you and I were both in there trying to like clamp this jugular vein. And I was awesome. That was like one of the highlights. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
And then I guess, yeah, coming away from that, I always knew that I wanted to work in emergency. And on graduation, I accepted an internship position at the Animal Emergency Service in Brisbane. The internship was 6 months, so I completed that and then took on a full-time role as an emergency veterinarian with AES, and I've been there for the past nearly 3 years now.
Wow, so 3 years.
It's gone very, very quickly, and yeah, you kind of lose track of all the insane, crazy cases that you manage until you go scrolling back through your camera roll and you're like, holy moly, I've actually, you know, I did that, I managed that. Yeah. But yeah, it's been a really crazy time, and starting to come up next June, I'll be sitting my membership exam. So that's kind of my next goal, my next hurdle to get through.
That's awesome.
And then in between that, I guess, my second focus is social media and really just spreading awareness about our profession, about the role of an emergency clinician, about the cases that we manage, and about mental health in the profession too, and providing support for vet students and veterinarians.
That's awesome. And 6 months, I'm just going to quickly bug you about your internship. 6 months is a fairly short internship. Was that routine? Is that what they just do at the AES, or?
Yeah. So AES has a very different internship program. It's basically an induction into being an AES vet, and the period of the internship varies on each person.
Okay.
So we all have to sit the Accelerate Emergency course, and that's a 12-week course. And it's run through Improve International, so that's the course that we do. But during that time, we may spend a month, 2 months, 3 months shadowing another veterinarian.
Oh, nice.
And then we transition into doing our own consults. So it's really person-dependent,
nice.
And they tailor the internship program to the individual vet.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Did you find that it was a good internship in terms of like getting the support you needed, because I'm sure you know not all internships are created equally. How did you feel that? That sounds like an amazing internship. Was it, what was it like?
The internship itself was incredibly supportive. I don't think I could have asked for a better program to be involved in. You know, we had a senior vet by our side every single step of the way for the first 6 months. We were
That's awesome.
We never, although we made decisions by ourselves, we never felt that even that process we were alone in. And then you've got all the incredible nurses to support you as well in your decision making too, because chances are they've seen the case more than you have and they know exactly the treatment that you're supposed to do, but they let you figure that out on your own. But yeah, it was an incredibly supportive program. And then even transitioning into being an emergency clinician, one of my first F-flaps was a intussusception, and
hysterectomy,
and a gastrotomy.
Oh gosh!
And that was my first X-flap surgery. And there was another senior vet there. She scrubbed in with me. It was, I didn't even have to ask for her to come in and help. She was just there.
Yeah.
And I think it was a really, really important moment because you never feel like you're in the deep end by yourself.
Yeah. Oh,
but
that's
I mean
good.
That experience is for everyone. I think some people like to be in the deep end by themselves and kind of figure it out and, you know, work their way through it. But for me, that's not how I learn. I find that would be very stressful.
That's great. Yeah, an intussusception by yourself for the first time, that would be... They can be really messed up surgeries. They can be, like, really easy. They're just like, boop, and then everything's fine. Or they can be, like, necrotic, gross, nasty...
Yeah.
Disasters.
It was a disaster. It really was. It was so bad.
And then with your social media stuff, you have also published a book, correct? Do you want to tell us about that? Because that's very exciting.
So when I was posting a lot of my cases on Instagram, I would always get a lot of questions about, oh, how do you manage this case? What's your approach to this case? And honestly, in emergency, we probably have, you know, top 10 common case presentations that we see.
Yeah.
And even though each case may be different in little ways, certainly your approach to stabilization and the diagnostic process doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I was like, well, why don't I just put it in a book and make it affordable for vet students and new graduates?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even if it's something that, you know, a vet student or a new grad pulls out when they're after hours by themselves and they can just pull out this book and
yeah.
have it as a guide. And if they don't have the support there to have them, you know, if they don't have the help, then maybe my book can be that support to show them, you know, the...
Yeah.
right way to, or a suggestion in terms of how to do the stabilization and diagnostics
yeah.
associated. So, yeah, really I kind of wanted to bridge that gap for new graduates to have a bit of practical support because, you know, you pull out a textbook and it tells you to do all these things and none of it mm-hmm. makes sense. And then you got to look up in the book in terms of how to do something else. And,
yeah.
yeah, I kind of really wanted to condense that information into one easy resource.
Yeah, I think it's, I've looked at little snippets and I love that it's, one of my favorite emergency textbooks is Carol Matthews, Emergent Critical Care by Carol Matthews, that yellow book, and hers, mm-hmm. it's very in-depth, but it goes through things very stepwise. So I like that because if you have an emergency come in, you're like, what do I do? But you really need to know the disease condition. Like you need
yeah.
to have already gone to that next step for that textbook to be helpful. So you can be like, okay, this is DK. How do I manage it step by step?
Yeah.
And I love yours because it's like that, the step before that book,
yeah.
you know, it's the, oh shoot, I don't know what's going on. This thing is not very good. And I just need to make it better so that I can get to the next step to figure out what's going on. And it's just so great to have something where someone can just go to that and have that practical, like you said, practical. It's not like it's easy to read. It's like, it's
yeah,
not,
exactly.
it's not over your head. It's
there's
just
no huge technical terms in there.
Yeah.
They're straightforward, straight to the point.
Yeah. That's awesome. I think it's amazing. Did you feel like putting that out? How did that feel? Did you feel a component of imposter syndrome? Did you have support from those around you? Did you have people being like, what are you doing? Like, how was that process of putting that out? Because it's scary, I'm sure.
Yeah, certainly. It was nerve-wracking. I mean, there was certainly a moment that was like, who am I to put out a resource? And I, at that stage, I'd only been graduated 2 years. I was like, who am I to, I've only been graduated 2 years. What do I know? But then, you know, I was talking to Alex about it and she said, just do it.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, there's no other resources out there like this. I offer a really unique perspective as a new graduate in
yeah.
terms of how to work up cases. And the big boost of confidence that I got was realizing that every single vet at AES works up their cases the same way I do.
Yeah.
Whether they've been graduating 10 years or 2 years. So
yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Did you feel, or did you get any kind of backlash from anyone, from like classmates or colleagues, or was everybody around you supportive? Like I was saying, I want to chat with you about that tall poppy syndrome. I'm sure being as successful and as young as you are, which is amazing, I'm sure you're going to hit that and feel that, especially in Australia where tall poppy syndrome is more of a thing than say North America. How were your experiences with that?
I think I was very lucky. I keep my work life and Instagram life separate in terms of my approaches of work. I don't really talk about what I post on social media. I don't really talk about my projects because they are two separate things. Mm-hmm. But certainly one of my colleagues from work proofread my book for me. It really showed her support. And then, I was telling my friends about, you know, how many copies I'd sold, and they were really, really supportive. And then obviously having Alex and Dorado having my back is a really huge component too. And I guess the good thing about Instagram is that it is such a positive space between vets and vet students. You know, you don't really see a whole lot of backlash against putting out resources because everybody just wants to put out resources to help each other. And we all cover such different spheres. And I mean, you see a lot on Instagram now, people are putting out different resources, but everyone puts it out in a different sector. You know, Alex and Gerardo do personal and professional development and clinical topics, but they produce it at a much higher level. They do videos. Louise the vet has just done a clinical ebook that hers is GP related. The foreign vets are putting out a veterinary program for Polish vet students. So we kind of all have our little sectors and our little niches. Yeah. So it doesn't even feel like we're competing, which I think is really nice because we have our own little sector and then we support each other equally, which I think is really lovely too. Yeah. Occasionally you'll get, actually, honestly, I don't think I've really had any negative messages.
Good.
I mean, I've been really lucky.
I was surprised.
I don't know what people are saying behind my back. I don't know about for the most part, it's been really, really positive.
Good. Yeah, I was so surprised. I'm not a social media person by any means. And Instagram, like, I don't have a personal Instagram. And going on to Instagram for Kick-Ass Vets, I was really apprehensive because all you hear about is like, oh, social media, negative, negative, negative. But it is, in the vet world anyways, it's been incredibly positive and incredibly supportive. So it's, I think you're right. We are really lucky that we're in this age and sphere of positive mental health and support. And I think the fact that there are so many other people putting out resources, when I was doing reading about the tall poppy syndrome, one of the big ways to combat it is to surround yourself with other people that are pushing the envelope. So they say you're a product of the five people you interact with most. So the fact that on Instagram you can connect with all of these other people putting out those resources is probably really helpful as well, instead of, you know, being surrounded by people that are like, you know, struggling to maybe find their niche or their path, if that makes sense. So it's, I was surprised at how positive Instagram has been, because it gets this like negative rap, right? Like it's like, oh, it's social media. Like I was expecting to just get absolutely attacked, and I haven't really had any, like one person was like, oh, what about this? And then it just opened lines of dialogue and communication, which was nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In terms of tall poppy, one of the other things that I feel it, when I was doing the research for it, there's some crazy, crazy stats just even in general with females, especially in Australia. Like 87% of these people in this study found their achievements were undermined by their colleagues and their coworkers. And I know with like at AES, it's supposed to be a very good, positive work environment. Do you find that it's been good? Because I know a lot of other people in the vet world, when they go to ask for a raise or when they want to accomplish things, they get squashed or told that they're being greedy or whatever. Do you find that because you're in this I guess, a higher level of a hospital, if that makes sense, in a lot of ways, medicine and emotional health. Have you found that that's been pretty supportive in your career in general, separate from your other stuff?
I think it all comes back to really the directors of AES. You know, you've got Rob Webster and Simon and Gerardo and Alex. And when Rob created AES, his whole mantra was he wanted it to be a home for emergency veterinarians, and he wanted to be able to deliver the best standard of care and also to encourage veterinarians to really reach their full potential. And we have a performance review every 6 months.
Oh, good.
They review our financials and they review how much we've generated for the clinic, how much we make per consult, how much we make in comparison to the other vets. And it's a very, very objective way to give people a raise. And if you, we don't even know what our objectives are. So there's no, you know, oh, I've got to make this amount of money, but it's all like behind the scenes. So when we have our review, they say, you know, I've noticed that you're doing this, this, and this. You've generated this much money and here's your raise.
Yeah. And it's great that it's like, transparent.
That's great. And they have our little graphs of, you know, where we are against everyone else in the practice, and they're an X and, you know, there's our name. So it's all anonymous, but we can see where we are against our colleagues as a motivating factor as well. And I think the biggest thing too is everyone in the clinic celebrates their own achievements. You know, we will have a massive night in the hospital and we'll cut a GDV, a splenectomy, have a dog attack, an esophageal foreign body, and like 10 crashes. And the next morning you wake up and we have a high fives page on Slack, and someone will put up a high fives post congratulating their team. And then everyone will comment and say, you know, congratulations and good work. Mm-hmm. So really it's fostering such a positive attitude. And then we also have a very, very big focus that everyone knows that when you do a GDV surgery or you have a crazy thoracotomy, that no one did it alone, and it's always a team effort.
Yeah.
So I think that also combats a lot of that negative, oh, she did this or he did that. It's no, the whole team did it together, and there's no jealousy associated with it because you're just really amazed at, you know, the feats of patient care that we can deliver more so than anything.
Yeah.
And I think all of that comes back to the culture that, that the directors cultivate and what Alex and Gerardo really cultivate. You know, you see them modeling such, you know, supportive behavior, you know, and then the rest of the team just follows that.
Yeah.
And then in their hiring choices as well, they hire vets not just for their qualifications, but probably more in spite of their qualifications, to be honest. You know, they hire new graduates because they know that they're going to fit in well with the team rather than just choosing the smartest people who aren't necessarily going to fit in well. And I think that makes a big difference too.
I love that they have this open discussion with this is what you're bringing in, because so many, when you talk to people about money and what they're worth and whether or not they deserve a raise, it's always so ambiguous. It's so hidden. It's such a mystery. So the fact that they're just open and honest and saying, this is what you're bringing in, this is what you're financially worth to the clinic, plus the other factors, and it just takes that mystery away. And it sounds like they've done a really good job just being able to talk about money without that negative feeling, which so many clinics, I think, really struggle. And a lot of questions, what you brought up a bunch of questions, so I'm going to jump over a little bit. First of all, you know, obviously working on commission, a lot of vets are like, oh, working on commission, there's going to be a push to over-service. My opinion and the stats show that we're incredibly underservicing in general in the veterinary world. I don't think any of us are in it to overservice, or a very tiny percent. So I think that's probably unlikely. But do you ever feel like, do you ever feel that you have a situation where that overservicing comes into play, or like, how does that work into working on commission?
I think honestly, we are so busy at night that we don't have time to offer diagnostics that don't need to be done. Yeah. You know, if it's a 1 out of 5 lame dog, you mention radiographs to cover your ass, basically.
Of course.
In case something goes wrong and you put it in your discharge notes that it was offered.
Yeah.
But then the way in which you word it to clients is, look, certainly we can do radiographs tonight, but we can equally also try anti-inflammatories and rest at home, yeah, and then x-rays in a few days if it doesn't get better.
Yeah.
And honestly, I just think, you know, another one of our policies at AES is only do what you would do for your own dog.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another really strong guiding policy that we have. And yeah, we are so busy at night that we don't have time to do useless procedures that don't need to be done. You know, there are plenty of other more critical patients that,
yeah,
that need our care. You know, we don't need to be doing GP x-rays. We don't even have dental equipment to, you know.
Yeah. I know. People come, they're like, can you just pull out its teeth? I'm like, no.
No,
we're not doing that.
Our nail clippers.
We're not effing the lump that's been there for 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. You know, little things like that. You know, you treat the condition that they're there for, and you may recommend a whole bunch of diagnostic tests because you're genuinely worried about what you're going to find or what you could find.
Mm-hmm.
Or you need to rule out the life-threatening things because if you miss it, you know that they're going to die.
Yeah.
Like a tick flip, you know, if a dog presents with mild ataxia and it's tick season, we tick clip everything.
We do too.
Some might see that as over-servicing, but we know the side effects of what happens when you miss a tick. And I think that all comes down to communication as well.
Yeah.
You know, communicating with the owners effectively. But I don't think over-servicing happens as much as people think it does because, like, if you ask any vet if they've ever had a lunch break, I just don't think we have that.
What is that? What is that word? What is it? Break? I don't know what that means.
I don't think we have the time to. And I mean, I think honestly working on commission motivates you to provide the best care even at 5 a.m. in the morning,
yeah,
when you're due to go home in an hour. You know, that's a good motivating factor to say, no, I'm here. I still need to provide care for these pets and I've got an hour, and in that hour I can make a difference. Yeah. And I had a case a few months ago where it had mild abdominal pain. It woke up, it had one vomit. And we had 2 hours before the clinic shut. And I was like, oh, well, I haven't done much tonight. I should offer to do full diagnostics because we could find something.
Mm-hmm.
And turned out the dog had a septic abdomen and a liver abscess.
Yeah.
And I went to the specialist for surgery and it was on the table within 6 hours and it was, yeah, home in 2 days. And, you know, you just shudder to think what would happen if you didn't offer. And then it went to red vet, and yeah, then they gave it a syringe injection because it wasn't that sick at the time, and yeah, then it went home, and then it came back 24 hours later. You know, that patient would have been in a very, very different situation. So I think sometimes it's a good kick up the butt to just keep working hard and not.
Yeah, that's such a great point.
In the morning, you can feel pretty lazy sometimes.
Oh, I know. When it's like, when the phone rings at like 5:15 and you're like, either get here right now or get here at 6:01. That's the worst when you've had like just a crazy night. But yeah, no, it's, I think one thing that I've learned, because I've been doing Emerge for, I guess, 6 years now, time has gone by, but one thing I've learned is the diagnostics will surprise me, and,
yeah,
like, you can't gauge always that the animal's going to be fine based on the fact that it's not that sick.
Every single day, I am surprised and reminded, yeah, of why we offer the diagnostics,
yeah,
because, yeah, we find stuff and it just goes, oh yeah, this is why I offer it, and yeah, this is why I talk to my owners about these things.
Do you guys, do you get a lot of slack back from your, like, working eMERGE? Do you get a lot of slack back from your GPs that you have over-serviced or over-pushed in that sense? Because, like, working eMERGE in a lot of different places, that's one of the big issues that you get, is you get a lot of slack from the GP vets being like, oh, you know, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And we do it because we see the crap when it goes badly.
I mean, look, certainly we do to some degree, but we've worked very, very hard to create a good relationship with our primary vet. Mm-hmm. And for many of our primary vets, they know that we're a really good emergency clinic, and they know that, yeah, sometimes we make mistakes and we work things up and we don't find anything, and that's just the reality of veterinary medicine. But chances are, if we work something up, we're going to find something.
Yeah.
And they understand that. And then, you know, we've set up this clinical support line where they can call our senior vets at any time during the day.
Oh, nice.
And catch up on their cases as well. So really we've worked really hard to foster a relationship of learning and a supportive environment. And I think, and also we put a lot of detail in our histories as to why we've done these diagnostic tests and what we're worried about we would find and things like that. So I think that helps clear up a lot of confusion. And I mean, certainly you'll come across it. I think in emergency and critical care, you know, you have a due diligence to do things thoroughly. That's why owners are there to see you.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, we're reasonably lucky that, yeah, we've worked hard to create a good relationship with our primary vets, and some like it and some don't. I'm sure it's pretty normal. But I think for the most part, they understand where we're coming from when we do the test, and that's why they refer their patients to us. If they don't like us, they don't refer their patients to us, and that's fine.
Yeah. Do you do anything else? Like, do you do any ongoing learning or seminars or, like, meetings or whatever? I just feel like emergency clinics have such an opportunity to create, like you said, this pot of learning around them. What does your clinic do that other clinics might be able to model and improve
on? Every 3 months, the Sunshine Coast, Underwood, Jindalee, and the Gold Coast, so across our four clinics, they run emergency seminars for primary vets. And at the moment it's webinars, unfortunately, but otherwise it's, you know, down at the pub and there's a big screen and you sit down and you have a lecture, and afterwards there's drinks and food and it's really, a networking place. But that's something that we do every 3 months, you know, whether it's surgical emergencies or endocrine emergencies, because that shows primary vets, you know, what we do, why we work up cases, and also is a CPD opportunity for them too. So, I think it's made a big difference as well.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome. It's awesome that you're at such a great clinic. It makes such a difference working
at
a... And the other thing we wanted to chat about was imposter syndrome. How have you felt that you've experienced that in your clinical work? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, certainly. I think the biggest imposter syndrome period that I went through was in my first year. I just finished my internship. I just finished this insane surgery that was a thoracotomy, XLAP, like dog attack, got ripped to shreds. I called Gerardo in at like 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And we got through this surgery together, and it was like 10 hours under anesthetic. It was insane. And I got through that surgery, and then everyone was saying how amazing I did. And all I could think of was I couldn't do it by myself. I had to get someone in to help me. And then I just, got stuck in this cycle of, you know, I'm not good enough. Look at all these other amazing vets in the practice that I'm working with, and they're so amazing. And if a patient ends up with me, I'm not going to be able to offer the same level of care that, you know, another vet could offer. I was in a surgery one day, and I was like, oh, if another vet was doing this, they would probably do it better than me, and they would close this wound better than me. And then it got to the point where I was chatting to my manager about it, and to Alex, and I took some time off. I went to New Caledonia and sat on a beach for 2 weeks.
Nice.
And turned off my phone and turned off everything related to work. Mm-hmm. And it was then that I realized the only difference between me and another vet was experience. And that's nothing I can change. Yeah. That's just a factor of, you know, when I graduated and, you know, that's at that moment, that's when I realized, you know, I look at all these amazing achievements that I've completed in, you know, 8 months. I just helped with this insane surgery and the dog went home and it lived.
Yeah.
And yeah, me just repeating to myself that the only difference is experience, and I'm in the best place to get that experience. Mm-hmm. And then I did some more study, you know, all these little things that I could do to help myself know more and learn more. And it made a huge difference, and taking that time off as well was really, really useful. And then by then I don't think I've really felt it since.
Good.
Which is good. So yeah, but I think it's something probably everyone comes across with. I think, you know, even at the time I didn't realize it was imposter syndrome literally until about a year later. And I was like, oh yeah, that's what it was called. But I think everyone feels it, whether they recognize it or not, or whether you put a label on it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great that you were able to take that time and, you know, just reevaluate. And it is, it's all about experience. And I think a big part of imposter syndrome, especially in veterinary medicine, when we are expected, like the expectations on vets are so incredibly high. And like GPs, when owners don't want to go for referral and they have these complicated cases, that in human medicine, that would be worked on by probably 5 different specialists that have done residencies for years and years and years in each field. And then you have a GP vet that A, has a chock full schedule on top of trying to manage these incredibly difficult cases on a budget. And when I was in my first year out, one of the big things, I had a patient die under anesthetic, and it was the most devastating thing ever. And I just thought, like, what am I doing here? This is terrible. Like, I don't deserve to be here. This is awful. And I had to sit down and I had to forgive myself for not being a specialist in every field. And that was one of the biggest things that was, I think, freeing for me, was to just acknowledge I cannot be a specialist in every field. That's impossible. That's insane. Yeah. That's a crazy goal. And to just acknowledge where you are and what's feasible and what's not feasible, and for you to acknowledge experience will come with time and there's nothing I can do to change it, and to kind of forgive yourself and do the very best that you can for every single patient, but at the same time, forgive yourself and understand that you're not going to be perfect. You are going to make mistakes, and that's okay, is important, and to learn from it. But yeah, it's a really hard job, and I feel like we're more prone to imposter syndrome and more prone to those things because we have such high expectations by the public. They're like, oh, vets, you should know everything about every single species. Like, the public expects you to be able to, like, walk out the door and do an amputation on an elephant. Like, they're like, how would you know how to do that? It's just crazy. It's crazy. So it's quite difficult.
Definitely. And I also don't think it helps, you know, on Instagram, we share the highlight reels. And for a lot of new graduates, that's all that they see. And, you know, they look at their colleagues and all that they see is the good things. You know, the colleagues don't share the bad cases or what's gone wrong. I think within our profession, we're not very good at sharing that with each other.
Yeah.
Aside from our really close friends.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's really difficult. And one of the best things that we did when we all graduated was on our year Facebook page, we put up a thread of our mistakes.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it was, some of it was just downright hilarious. Like, stuff that you were like, oh God, I can't even believe that that happened, because it's so freaking funny.
Yeah.
You know, one of the people in my year accidentally intubated the esophagus, and then the tube ended up in her stomach.
Oh,
so the stay turned into a gastrotomy.
Oh, the poor thing.
But, like, just stuff like that. You're like, how does that even happen? him. And you just have to laugh about it because it's so funny.
Yeah.
And the dog was fine. But, you know, that mistake literally happened to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, we've all accidentally intubated the esophagus before.
Yeah.
So that's one of the best things that we did. And I think that helped for our year, knowing, you know, none of us are perfect. We all made mistakes.
Yeah.
We all missed things. We all missed diagnoses in our first year out, and that's totally normal.
Yeah. That's amazing that your class did that. When I had that dog die, I talked to classmates of mine because I was obviously, you know, devastated. And one of my classmates shared with me that he realized, like, 15 minutes into a deobstipation of a cat, that the cat was dead. He was like, the cat had died under anesthetic probably 5 minutes before the nurse, and he was so focused on deobstipating, and nobody talks about it. There's this huge shame behind making mistakes, and it's one of, like, dealing with mistakes appropriately and learning from mistakes is something I'm really passionate about, especially having gone through that and looking at the medical biases that we have in our brains that lead to mistakes. So I have blogs on all of those. But one of the things that I found incredibly helpful when I moved to Australia, actually through the Green Cross AEC clinics in Melbourne, in Victoria, they run morbidity and mortality rounds. So once a month between the different centers, they have morbidity and mortality rounds where they go through a case with a fine-tooth comb with the benefit of hindsight, no judgment. And that is, I think, one of the best things that we can do, because we can teach each other about mistakes, we can talk about it openly, we can take the shame and the stigma away, and we can all learn from it. And I think it's such an underutilized tool, and just that little group that you have on Facebook is a mini version of morbidity mortality rounds, and I wish more people would do that. Do you guys do that through the AESs? Do you ever have them?
We do it occasionally, especially if there's one case that really needs drawing attention to. I mean, the other couple of months ago we had a situation where radiographs were labeled the wrong way. The wrong leg was labeled.
Yeah.
And the patient was labeled, and, you know, that came with its own issues. And we sat down and we had an objective, you know, meeting about what can we do differently next time. It was one of those nights where shit just hit the fan and you couldn't have done anything differently in that moment because it was just nuts. Hindsight is a really great lesson.
Mm-hmm.
We sit down and we have those meetings and those talks. And I think within the practice itself, it's so important to create an environment where nurses and vets can come to each other if they've made a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, the other day we had one of our nurses accidentally bolus an entire vial of fentanyl. She hooked it up to the wrong pump.
Yeah.
And she ran and told the vets straight away. We reversed it with naloxone and the patient was fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, no harm done. You know, we got on top of it within literally 30 seconds. But you can just imagine if that nurse was worried about the vet getting mad at her.
Yeah.
You know, how much longer would she have waited to tell the vet?
Yeah.
You know, the other day we were managing like 4 crash patients at once, and one of them was seizuring, and it was like a 3-kilo dog, and I was like, oh, just give it 3 mils of Diet. And I was like, oh, wait, that's so wrong. And then I looked up the dosages, and it was fine, and I sat down, and I told the team, so I was like, so this dog's going to sleep for a really long time because I overdosed it.
Yeah.
So just, we're going to do extra obs on it, but it'll be okay.
Yeah.
And I told my entire nursing team that because I think it's, you know, good for them to see that we make mistakes as well.
Of course.
I think it's really good to continue to foster that environment. And I think as vets, that's part of our responsibility.
Yeah. I worked one time with a vet that was less approachable, and this nurse came up and you could just like see in her face, she was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I was like, what's wrong? What's going on? She was like, oh my gosh, I've just overdosed a patient. I was like, okay, which one is it? And it was the other vet's case, but they were too afraid to tell the other vet. And that happens so many times where mistakes are made, and if they're not addressed right away, they can be an issue. And yeah, I think fostering that supportive environment and showing, like you said, saying we screwed up, yep, that was me, is, and showing that it's okay, is really important, because having that safe and supportive environment in a clinic is like drastically important for patient care and also mental health of the people working there. So that's I think a really important point. So I think it's great to bring up. So that I don't keep you forever, and I'm trying to, what ends up happening with these things is they end up going, and I just end up going on tangents and then chatting forever, and then they're like 2 hours long. So instead of keeping you forever, do you have any general pieces of advice for new graduates or, you know, people thinking of emergency, just any tidbits that you'd like the world to know?
I think we just have to be kind to ourselves and forgive ourselves that are not very good at that.
Yeah.
I think as a general rule, you know, we're all type, nearly all of us are type A personalities. That's why we got into this job. You know, that's why we made the grades to be a vet. So we're not very good at forgiving ourselves. We're not very good at letting go of mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think the best way to address mistakes is to look at it objectively. Sometimes it may take a few days to let the emotions kind of ring out and go through the wash, but certainly looking at mistakes objectively is the most important thing. And if you can't do it, talking to someone else and getting them to look at it objectively for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, one of the biggest things. And just, like, as a new graduate, to celebrate every single little win. I mean, I placed a female urinary catheter for the first time the other day, and I could not stop jumping up and
down. That's amazing.
So exciting. I still get excited every time I do an X-lap. Like, not downplaying, you know, exciting moments in our career just because, you know, for the way it might look, you know, celebrate each little achievement because it's so important. And if we don't celebrate the achievements, then we're going to dwell on the shit stuff. So I think you've got to balance it out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. Female urinary catheters are so hard. I don't know what happened. Like, I think about a year ago, for years and years, I couldn't get one in. And then about a year ago, I had one and it just went in, like, magically. And then since then, I've had like four, and they've all just magically gone in. And people are like, how do you get them in so fast? I was like, I literally don't know. I don't know. I think my only trick is use a guide wire.
Yeah.
If you don't use a guide wire, and anesthetize them. Because then otherwise they're fighting you. I think those are the only two consistent things. But otherwise it's just like...
luck.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. Yeah, I get excited too when I get them in. I'm like, there's pee! Liquid gold!
I agree. I know that feeling very well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I think that everyone watching will take a lot of value from that. And I think, thank you for taking your time. And I'm so excited for your book, and I'll put links and everything to the books. I just am so excited for you and for where your career is going. And I'm so excited to see what you're going to do next. Cause I just, you know, you've taken off like a rocket, and I just, it's so amazing and so inspiring to see vets just embracing and saying, this is who I am, this is what I want to be. And you embrace your successes, you embrace your mistakes, and you don't hide things. And I think that's such a valuable lesson for all of us. Like you said, we need to, you know, not have shame, not have stigma, and to celebrate our successes. So it's wonderful that you're doing that. And I hope that other people see what you're doing and are inspired to do the same. So thank you so much for joining us.
Mary, thank you so much. It was really good.
All right.